Sahana Vavatu, Sahanao Bhunaktu, Sahaviryan Karavavahai, Tejasvinavadhitamastu Mavidivishabahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Om Jaya Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shiva Sari Gaura Bhakta Vrinda. Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare Hare. Hare Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. Page 48. Srila Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur comments, because the moon god shows favor to Rohini constellation and ignored the others, Daksha became angry and cursed him to suffer from consumption, which wastes the body away. Thus he did not bear children in them. Right, so Daksha's, you know, his whole thing is that now by his anger and all that. That's the problem. Anger and that, then one does foolish things. And so now, instead of, you know, he has 27 of his daughters, so he has the most, right? And so then he'll get no children from them. Sukadeva Goswami continued.
So if we have anger, or if we feel it, it's kind of part of conditioning, mm-hmm. What should we do about
it? You have to use intelligence, really. Because that's the problem, that's the thing that goes in anger, is intelligence. So if you focus on intelligence, then one can understand. It's not nice, it may be wrong, it may be this, that, but still one has to be very careful how one responds. Otherwise then we make it worse. Like here, he makes it worse. You know, he's not associating properly with all the daughters, only one. So then he curses them, and then he can't associate with any of them. So, you know, that didn't seem to work out so good. You know, like that.
Yeah, okay. All right, and if we just don't work on it and hold it?
Then the point is then it'll... I mean, eventually it depends, it kind of goes away, but it can always create so much trouble. You know, because... it's a matter of intellectually looking at it, and then, you know, what's the whole point? What's the real thing to learn? You know, what's the actual Krishna conscious point? What's the actual problem? And then take it up to something higher. So instead of just discussing the issue itself, you go up to a higher level of, you know, what is Krishna consciousness? And, you know, the whole point, until you get back to Krishna and, you know, him and his associates, and, you know, the name, form, qualities, pastimes, like that. Because these lower levels, that they're never... You follow the rules, then you get things work nicely. But you know, there's always that combination. So there's something that always obstacles and people's different moods and all that. So never quite. You do your best at it. That's the thing. You do your best at that to serve Krishna. But at the same time, as there's going to be always an obstacle like that. So that's why it's, if you can take it to the higher platform, it's better, because then you don't care. You know, issues aren't an issue anymore. When you, does that make sense?
Sri Sukadeva Goswami continued, thereafter the king of the moon pacified Prajapati Daksha with courteous words and thus regained the portions of light he had lost during his disease. Nevertheless, he could not beget children. The moon loses its shining power during the dark fortnight, and in the bright fortnight it is manifest again. O King Pariket, now please hear from me the names of Kasyapa's wives, from whose wombs the population of the entire universe has come. They are the mothers of almost all the population of the entire universe, and their names are very auspicious to hear. They are Aditi, Diti, Danu, Kashta, Arishta, Surasa, Ila, Muni, Krodhavasha, Tamra, Surabhi, Sharama, and Tumi. From the womb of Tumi, all the aquatics took birth. Oh, so the Timangila. Okay, from Timi. Okay. And from the womb of Sharama, the ferocious animals like tigers and lions took birth. My dear King Pariket, from the womb of Surabhi, the buffalo, cow, and other animals with cloven hooves took birth.
For in the womb of Tamra, the eagles, vultures, and other large birds of prey took birth. And from the womb of Muni, the angels took birth. The sons born of, so that means the Gandharvas. The sons born of Krodavasha were the serpents known as Dandasuka, as well as other serpents and the mosquitoes. All the various creepers and trees were born from the womb of Ila. The Rakshasas, bad spirits, were born from the womb of Surasa. The Gandharvas were born from the womb of Arishta. So then this must mean the angels means the female Gandharvas. And these are the male. Okay. O king, from the womb of Danu came 61 sons, of whom these 18 were very important. Dvimurdha, Sambhara, Arishta, Hayagriva, Vibhavasu, Ayomukha, Shankushira, Swarbhanu, Kapila, Aruna, Puloma, Vrishaparva, Ekachakra, Anutapana, Dumrakesha, Virupaksha, Viprachiti, and Durjaya. The daughter of Sarbanu, named Suprabha, was married by Namuchi. The daughter of Rishaparva, named Sarmishta, was given to the powerful king Yayati, the son of Nahusha. Vaishvanara, the son of Danu, had four beautiful daughters named Upadanavi, Hayashirsha, Puloma, and Kalaka. Hiranyaksha married Upadhanavi, and Kratu married Hayashirsha. Thereafter, at the request of Lord Brahma, Prajapati Kasyapa married Puloma and Kalaka, the other two daughters of Vaishvanara. From the wombs of these two wives of Kasyapa came 60,000 sons, headed by Nivadakavacha, who were known as the Pulomas and Kalakeyas. They were physically very strong and expert in fighting, and their aim was to disturb the sacrifices performed by the great sages. My dear king, when your grandfather Arjuna went to the heavenly planets, he alone killed all these demons, and thus King Indra became extremely affectionate towards him. Srila Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur elaborates. Vaishvanara was another son of Danu. Because he was ordered by Brahma, Kasyapa married Vaishvanara's daughters, who were his granddaughters. Through them, he bore 60,000 Nivadakavachas. Sri Sukadeva Goswami continued. In his wife, Simhika, Viprachiti begot 101 sons, of whom the eldest is Rahu, and the others are 100 Ketus. Well, it seems that you have the eldest is Rahu, and then you have the 100 Ketus, but when Rahu's body is cut off, the body is Ketu. So, just the head stays as Rahu.
So,
oh, Ketus are the comets. I mean, like Halley's and all those guys. Ketus are the comets. Okay. Yeah. That's something interesting that they say. I think Mark Twain, he was born when Halley's comet came, and he died the day that the comet, when the comet came again and left. You know, so when it came in, he was born, and then however long the years later it is, it comes at a cycle. Then when it left, then he died. So if that has any significance, who knows, but he came in with the Ketus, went out with the Ketus.
But he usually dies with the
Ketus. Is that the theory? Yeah, Ketus, strong planet. Yeah, generally, Ketu is one of the markers. I think others can be also, but Ketus. But the thing about Ketu is also he's connected with liberation. So then that's also good. All of them attained positions in the influential planets. Now please hear me as I describe the descendants of Aditi in chronological order. In this dynasty, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Narayana, descended by his plenary expansion. The names of the sons of Aditi are as follows. Vivasvan, Aryama, Pusha, Tvashta, Savita, Bhaga, Datta,
Vidhata, Varuna, Mitra, Shatru, and Urukrama. So I think Datta and Vidhata are day and night. 22. His Holiness Bhanu Swami notes, Urukrama is Vamana, also known as Upendra, but different from the Upendra mentioned in verse 8, because there was one mentioned before. So the one who's Vishnu Murti, that's this one, Aditi's son. And the other just happened to have that name also. Samgya, the wife of Vivasvan, the sun god, gave birth to Manu, the Manu, named Shraddhadeva, footnote 23. Shraddhadeva is our current Manu, is also known as Vivasvata, meaning son of Vivasvan. In his previous life, he was King Satyavrata and was saved by Lord Matsya. Okay, so the same personality. And the same fortunate wife also gave birth to the twins Yamaraj on the river Jamuna. Okay, that was her, what was her name? Samgya, okay. When Yami, while wandering on the earth in the form of a mare, gave birth to the Ashwini Kumaras, Chaya, another wife of the sun god, begot two sons named Sanaishchara and Savarni Manu. Footnote 24. Savarni is the next, eighth Manu. And one daughter, Tapati, who married Samvarana. So then Yamini is also... Yeah. From the womb of Matrika, the wife of Aryama, were born many learned scholars. Among them, Lord Brahma created the human species, which are endowed with the aptitude for self-examination. Pusha had no sons. When Lord Shiva was angry at Daksha, Pusha had laughed at Lord Shiva and had shown his teeth. Therefore, he lost his teeth and had to live by eating only ground flour. Footnote 25. This is described in the fourth canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, chapters 5 through 7. Lord Shiva knocked him out, so it probably wouldn't work anyway. Rachana, the daughters of the Daityas, became the wife of Prajapati Tvashta. By his semina, he begot in her womb two very powerful sons named Sannivesha and Vishwarup. Although Vishwarup was the son of the daughter of their eternal enemies, the demons, the demigods accepted him as their priest in accordance with the order of Brahma, when they were abandoned by their spiritual master Brihaspati, whom they had disrespected. 37 to 45. Okay, Tvashta. Okay. There are no review questions or essay questions required for this chapter. Okay. I take it this is one of those more favored chapters. Next will be prescribed duties for mankind. Okay, study guide 3, the story of Vishwarup, chapters 7 to 9. Because he must ask about Vishwarup, because otherwise, why is it the Prashta is from the demigods, but his wife is the daughter of one of the demons, but Brahma asked that he become the priest for Brihaspati, for Indra, because he had insulted his spiritual master, he'd left. So then he came to do the yajnas. Chapter 7, Indra offends the spiritual master Brihaspati. There's the preface. It could be before. No, that's 3. That's 2. No, it's in that order. Okay, chapter 8, the Narayan covets a shield. 9, appearance of the demon Dhritarasura. Okay, preface. Hoshana, protection concerning Indra, who killed his guru, will be explained. The guru Vishwarupa was born from the son Tvashta of Daksha's daughter Aditi. Okay, so Aditi's son was Tvashta, and then from his wife, then you got Vishwarupa. Chapter 7. Indra offends the spiritual master, Brihaspati. Pratigya. Lord Brahma wanted to point out to the demigods that by the strength of the guru, one can become most powerful within this world. And by the displeasure of the guru, one can lose everything. The Pratigya of this chapter is taken from Srila Prabhupada's purport in verse 23. Right? Because before we said you have to approach the spiritual master. That's how one's going to develop or advance in anything. Right? So now here's being pointed out that Lord Brahma is making the point that you please the spiritual master, everything goes nice. You displease them, nothing goes nice. So that's the whole principle we see here by Indra, right? Because he material considerations and all that, then he misbehaved, and because of that, then problem is there, right? So that's two. He insulted Brihaspati, then he left. So then he got someone to do the sacrifice for him. So that was Vishwarupa, then he insulted him also. So he has a problem, Indra, right? So we see Indra, regularly does things like this. Prajapati Daksha, he's regularly doing stuff like this. Not as extreme. Daksha does, he just curses people, but here Indra actually tries to kill people. So. Chapter 7 summarizes questions and answers. Maharaj Prickett asked Sukadeva Goswami question 610 of Srimad Bhagavatam. Question 610, Srimad Bhagavatam 671. Maharaj Prickett inquired from Sukadeva Goswami, "O great sage, why did the spiritual master of the demigods, Brihaspati, reject the demigods, who were his own disciples? What offense did the demigods commit against the spiritual master? Please describe to me this incident." This question is addressed in verses 2 to 17 of this chapter. There are also several rhetorical questions asked in this chapter, but they do not fall into the study. Adhyaya Prakashika. The seventh chapter describes how the devatas, abandoned by their guru Brihaspati and defeated by the daityas, accepted Vishwarupa as their guru on the advice of Brahma. As related in this chapter, Indra, the king of heaven, committed an offense at the feet of his spiritual master Brihaspati. Brihaspati therefore left the demigods, who then had no priest. However, at the request of the demigods, Vishwarupa, the son of the Brahmana Tvashta, became their priest. Once upon a time, Indra, the king of the demigods, was sitting with his wife Sachi Devi and being praised by various demigods like the Siddhas, Charanas, and Gandharvas, when Brihaspati, the spiritual master of the demigods, entered the assembly. Indra, being too absorbed in material opulence, forgot himself and did not respect Brihaspati. Right? That's the difficulty. One has facilities, one may forget Krishna. So that's why many times when we have difficulties, we tend more to remember Krishna. Right? So that's why it comes up. If we'd always remember Krishna, then there doesn't have to be any difficulties. But then the difficulties would be there just to bring out rasa. In the spiritual world, nothing that they do gets in the way of devotional service, because that's the real work. We take it that manipulating the secondary aspects of devotional service, that's the real work. But actually, remembering Krishna and never forgetting him, that's the actual work. Does that make sense? Then we engage a secondary activity so that we can focus. Right? That's the whole thing. Okay, he did not respect Brihaspati, who thus became aware of Indra's pride in his material and in his material opulence, and immediately disappeared from the assembly to teach him a lesson. Indra became most repentant, understanding that because of his opulence, he had forgotten to respect his spiritual master. He left the palace to beg pardon from his spiritual master, but could not find Brihaspati anywhere. Because of his disrespectful behavior towards his spiritual master, Indra lost all his opulence and was conquered by the demons, who defeated the demigods in a great fight and occupied Indra's throne. King Indra, along with the other demigods, later took shelter of Lord Brahma. Understanding the situation, Lord Brahma chastised the demigods for their offense to their spiritual master. Following Lord Brahma's orders, the demigods accepted Vishwarup, who was a brahmana and the son of Twashta, as their priest. Then they performed yajnas under the priesthood of Vishwarup and were able to conquer the demons. Yes.
So here we talk about spiritual master only on the level of yajna?
That's one aspect of spiritual master. See, because Brihaspati would be the one who would head up all their yajnas. But otherwise, then there is the aspect that you're doing a yajna, the priest comes and he's the spiritual master during that time. Right? And so then, you know, how he says it should be done, what should be done, what's the moods, everything like that. So therefore, you pick proper priests to do things that could function in that capacity. And two, we accept them that way. You know, generally, they're just like a, you know, like you have a leak in your sink, you get a plumber, so you need to do a yajna to get a priest. You know, they have about the same position. You tell the plumber what to do, so you tell the priest what to do. But technically, the priest is supposed to be the spiritual master. You know, it may be just for that short time, for that it's for a specific function, the spiritual master, but still they're to be respected properly.
Because otherwise, if
Brihaspati
left,
then
you could find somebody else.
That's no, it's only because Brahma requested that.
I don't know what has this been.
That's right. Okay, Shloka Anusharanam. 1-17, Indra loses the shelter of Brihaspati. 18-25, the demons defeat the demigods. 26-40, the devatas take shelter of Vishwarup. 1-17. Maharaj Parikit inquired from Sugadeva Goswami, O great sage, why did the spiritual master of the demigods, Brihaspati, reject the demigods who were his own disciples? What offense did the demigods commit against their spiritual master? Please describe me this incident, right? Because he's going through all the list of names and he mentions something and he catches that and says, oh, please describe this. Right? Because otherwise that's how it is. It's just a list of all the dynasties and all the lines coming down. But then when there's something, of interest, then whoever they're discussing with to inquire about that, that will then therefore bring out that detail. So depending upon where the questions are asked, that's what makes that Purana, right? Does that make sense? So different details are dealt with. That gives those different Puranas. Right. Sugadeva Goswami said, O King, once upon a time, the King of Heaven, Indra, being extremely proud because of his great opulence of the three worlds, transgressed the law of Vedic etiquette. Seated on his throne, he was surrounded by the Maruts, Vasus, Rudras, Adityas, Ribhus, Vishwadevas, Sadyas, Ashwini Kumaras, Siddhas, Charanas, and Gandharvas, and by great saintly persons. Also surrounding him were the Vidyadharas, Apsaras, Kinaras, Patagas, birds, and Uragas, snakes. All of them were offering Indra their respects and services, and the Apsaras and Gandharvas were dancing and singing with very sweet musical instruments. Over Indra's head was a white umbrella as effulgent as the full moon, fanned by yak-tail whisk and served with all the paraphernalia of a great king. Indra was sitting with his wife, Satyadevi, who occupied half the throne. When the great sage Brihaspati appeared in that assembly, Brihaspati, the best of the sages, was the spiritual master of Indra and the demigods, and was respected by the demigods and demons alike. Nevertheless, although Indra saw his spiritual master before him, he did not rise from his own seat or offer a seat to a spiritual master, nor did Indra offer him a respectful welcome. Indra did nothing to show him respect, so he didn't rise, he didn't give him a seat, he didn't receive him with words, he did nothing to recognize his position, though he saw him, right? Yes.
This also shows the relationship between them, because it's like not only did he not respect him, but he doesn't love him.
Well, it's more a matter of. Here he's being distracted because of his material opulence.
But still, if you're sitting in your penthouse with your flat screen and then your best friend comes in, you're still hey.
Yeah, but you're not surrounded by so many journalists, tabloids, and everybody else who are glorifying you and wanting to know your opinion on everything. You understand? So that's what's happened. It means he's gotten distracted. He should not. It's his fault and it's wrong. But it happened because of, that's why we're always careful about position opulence. If we become proud, then this can happen. So. Brihaspati knew everything that would happen in the future. Seeing Indra's transgression of etiquette, he completely understood that Indra was puffed up by his material opulence. Although able to curse Indra, he did not do so. Instead, he left the assembly and in silence returned to his home. Because he knew what will happen because of this, then all the things will happen. So there's no need to curse. He's already going to be, the demons are going to come in and take over. Indra, the king of heaven, could immediately understand his mistake. Realizing he had disrespected his spiritual master, he condemned himself in the presence of all the members of the assembly. Right, so he immediately sees. That's why he's so pious. Otherwise, he only did 100 Ashwamedha yagyas by respecting his guru. Right, so now he comes to this position. You know, he respects Brahma and like this, but now and again he gets distracted. Because we have to remember he is the king of the demigods. So all the demigods are there, but he is in that respect senior to all of them. Of course, Brahma, Vishnu, Shiva, they're all senior to all of them. But still, amongst the 33 million demigods, he's senior. He's the king. Yeah. Indra's king, not Singh. Okay? Okay. Realizing he has disrespected his spiritual master, he condemned himself in the presence of all the members of the assembly. Alas, what a regrettable deed I have committed because of my lack of intelligence and my pride in my material opulences. I failed to show respect to my spiritual master when he entered the assembly. And thus I have insulted him. Although I am king of the demigods who are situated in the mode of goodness, I was proud of a little opulence and polluted by false ego. Under the circumstances, who in this world would accept such riches at the risk of falling down? Alas, I condemn my wealth and opulence. 2-12, Srila Prabhupada comments. According to the laws of nature, when one is extremely opulent, one becomes degraded. And this is true both individually and collectively. The demigods are situated in the mode of goodness, but sometimes even one who is situated in such an exalted position as King Indra, the king of all the demigods, falls down because of material opulence. We are now actually seeing this in America. The entire American nation has tried to advance in material opulence without striving to produce ideal human beings. The result is that Americans are now regretting the wholesale criminality of American society and wondering how America has become so lawless and unmanageable. But, you know, so it's just seen that so much craziness goes on. But it's because they've increased the opulence without increasing the character. So you have to do both at once. Right? So opulence is increased by better application of skill. So just as skill is improving, one should be improving one's character. Right? So that they haven't done, so now the skill has produced more opulence, people become proud, and then all kinds of difficulties come up. No, but they naturally don't have good character because previously they didn't strive for good character and they cultivated bad character.
And but nowadays with credit cards and all this, everyone has access to this amount of opulence that some of them do to them.
Yes, but the point is they've done something to get it. Point is they've done the piety to get the opulence, but because they didn't focus on developing character in the at the same time. Therefore, then one becomes proud of one's opulence. So, yeah. If the American people are serious about curbing the degraded criminal life of their nation, they must take to the Krishna conscious movement and try to create the kind of human society advised in Bhagavad Gita. Chaturvarnyam maya srishtam guna karma vibhagashaham. Bhagavad Gita 4:13. They must divide their society into first-class men, second-class, third-class, and fourth-class men, since they are now creating only men who are less than fourth-class. How can they avoid the dangers of a criminal society? Right? Because fourth-class means one's human.
It's just the general populace. So you don't have any specific outstanding character in these finer elements needed in society, right? For the whole society to run, there must be funds, money. So that's so someone who can work with that, that's considered third class. Because then you have all the money, which everybody can run with. But to be able to make money, there must be administration so that the everything is peaceful and orderly so that business can run. So that's considered the second class. And the first class is then the knowledge and character by which then you can administrate, make money and use money and therefore live your life. So that's considered first class. That's the best. Right? So, 1, 2, 3, 4, these are all together. Fifth class, that's where there's a big gap. Right? That's where the gap is, because they're not interested in the Vedic norms or following the laws of God very nicely, so therefore there's a problem. People follow the laws, they do better. That was the point. America before was based on religious and this and that. And so East Coast tended to be more like that, but as they extended across, people took their religion with them, but then in the ensuing opulence and facilities and all this that started to come, then with time they lost that religious focus. Right? And so then with that, then also all the criminality comes up. Because otherwise, if people were more religious and more, character-driven, then this was less. It's always there. There's always going to be the criminal element, but it doesn't become so prominent. Like I remember in our city they grew up in, it wasn't a small town, but it was a city, but small, not that big. Except if we went out traveling, then we'd lock the house. Otherwise you just didn't lock the house. No bars in the windows, huge windows. So it's just nobody ever, I never heard of it. You just didn't if you were visiting somebody, you just could knock on the door and just walk in. If you were friendly. If not, you knocked and waited. But
what was the city?
Eugene. Like that. So it means places were like that before. Like that. I don't know how it is now, but it was like that then. So you have something left over for when people are more religious. But then as that goes, then everything goes. Long, long ago, Lord Indra regretted his disrespect to his spiritual master, Brihaspati. Similarly, he's advised that the American people regret their mistaken advancement in civilization. They should take advice from the spiritual master, the representative of Krishna. If they do so, they will be happy and theirs will be an ideal nation to lead the entire world. Because they like to lead the world, but then you have to lead not just in material facility and opulence, but also in character. Otherwise, then the position is lost. King Indra continued, right? Because Indra is trying to be the lead of everyone, but if he disrespects, he loses everything. He behaves properly, then you can lead. So the point is if you have character, you can lead. King Indra continued, if a person says, one who is situated on the exalted throne of a king should not stand up to show respect to another king or a brahmana, it is to be understood that he does not know the superior religious principles. Right, because he's the king, so he doesn't have to stand up. But technically, then you don't actually understand the higher principles. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur comments, but do not the followers of Niti Shastra say that the king on the throne should not rise for anyone? They are mistaken. A person sitting on Brahma's throne should also rise. Right? So if someone superior comes, you always respect them. Right? So that's the point. Yeah? Srila Prabhupada adds, when a president or king is sitting on his throne, he does not need to show respect to everyone who comes within his assembly, but he must show respect to superiors like his spiritual master, Brahmanas and Vaishnavas. There are many examples of how he should act. When Lord Krishna was sitting on his throne and Narada fortunately entered his assembly, even Lord Krishna immediately stood up with his officers and ministers to offer respectful obeisances to Narada. Narada knew that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead,
And Krishna knew that Narada was his devotee. But although Krishna is the Supreme Lord, and Narada is the Lord's devotee, the Lord observed the religious etiquette. Since Narada was a brahmachari, a brahmana, and an exalted devotee, even Krishna, while acting as a king, offered his respectful obeisances unto Narada. Right? So he may be God, but he's taking the position of a king. So therefore, kings respect brahmins.
All of Narada's position and
yeah, because he's a devotee. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Like that. Because he's playing the part of the king.
Yeah.
So therefore. Is that a sentence? Yeah. Even Krishna, while acting as a king, offered his respectful obeisances unto Narada. Such is the conduct visible in Vedic civilization.
Hmm.
No, his father.
Yeah.
Ramaharshana Sutta. I mean, he's technically Sutta Goswami. Just he's Ramaharshana Sutta Goswami.
His point was that he was the Brahmana, and then Balaram was the Supreme Person of
Godhead. Yeah, well, he was looking at he's a Kshatriya, rather than looking at it he's God. So, you know, slight mis... You know, if it was a king, he doesn't have to stand up. But since it was the Supreme Lord, so Brahmins are worshipping Brahman, and he's the Supreme Brahman, so... worthwhile to stand up. Right? Because he was thinking because of his position, he was proud. It wasn't just he was speaking so nicely and absorbed or something, and then Balaram just quietly came in so not to disturb. You know, but he actually officially thought, no, I'm on the Vyasa Sana, I don't have to stand up for anybody. So that's where the problem was. It depends on the situation. If you're in the temple, you have to see what's there. If it's just they're coming for darshan and that, you can turn to the arti. If it's that they've come to the temple, you know, from outside and come to visit, and that then if no one else is taking care, then you could stop and see that they're taken care of and everything like that. Does that make sense? Because otherwise they're coming for darshan, and if you stop, it kind of yeah, doesn't works out so good. A civilization in which the people do not know how the representative of Narada and Krishna should be respected, how society should be formed, and how one should advance in Krishna consciousness. A society concerned only with manufacturing new cars and new skyscrapers every year, and then breaking them to pieces and making new ones, may be technologically advanced, but is not a human civilization, right? So here they're thinking that they're so advanced because they can build buildings and then they break them down and then make new ones. But at the same time as, what do you say about the civilization like the Romans, where then their buildings are protected, you know, because they're so special? So that means basically whatever they're building nowadays is so, you know, unspecial that nobody minds that you break it down. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that makes sense. You know, before it was people built something and it was meant to last. It was meant, you know, it was something of value.
People didn't build on building.
Sorry?
People didn't build on the plan. It will last only 20 years. About 15 years. They're not enough. There is nothing.
Oh, okay.
Already in the contract.
It's already in the contract.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, because in that time, then,
yeah.
You know.
That time will be new cost, new valuation, and they're going to revalue the client and give nothing.
Oh, well.
I told you that's fine.
Fun. Okay, so such a civilization may be technologically advanced, but it's not a human civilization. A human civilization is advanced when its people follow the Chaturvarnyam system, the system of four orders of life. There must be ideal first-class men to act as advisors, second-class men to act as administrators, third-class men to produce food and protect cows, and fourth-class men who obey the three higher classes of society. One who does not follow the standard system of society should be considered a fifth-class man. A society without Vedic laws and regulations will not be very helpful to humanity. As stated in this verse, dharmam te na param vidu. Such a society does not know the aim of life and the highest principle of religion. Right. So the whole point is technologically one's advancing, but what's the purpose of that? You know, I'm doing something, there should be a purpose. Like if I go into the kitchen and start peeling potatoes, there should be a purpose. If I'm just peeling potatoes because I can and I figured out newer and newer ways to and better ways to peel the potato, you know, then what's the point? That's the Yeah, technology is part of the Shudra thing, but it means the point is the Shudras, that's their part that they can add is all this technology. But there must be a reason for the technology. Why is technology there? You know, what are you supposed to do with it? There must be a purpose. Does that make sense? So that's the problem. Because basically it's working on, it's not following any of this order, so therefore fifth class men are developing all this technology and doing, you know, special things. But the point is, where's the direction? Right? Where's the administration? Where's the money? You know? So it's not that the society is necessarily more opulent. Does that make sense? That it's organized so nicely. And people have a direction in their life. You know, it's just left, everybody just does whatever they do. So... Right. So there's such a society, which means dharma, they don't know the aim of life and the highest principle of religion. In other words, religion has to be followed. That's the Chaturvanyam system. But the highest is devotional service. So therefore, socially one's organized according to Varnashram, but one does everything to please Krishna. Then it works nice. King Indra continued, leaders who have fallen into ignorance and who mislead people by directing them to the path of destruction, as described in the previous verse, are in effect boarding a stone boat, and so too are those who are blindly follow them. A stone boat would be unable to float and would sink in the water with its passengers. Similarly, those who mislead people go to hell, and their followers go with them. Srila Prabhupada comments, as stated in the Vedic literature, Srimad Bhagavatam 11.20.17, Nirideham Adhyam Sulabham Sudurlabham Plavam Sukalpam Guru Karana Dharam. We, the conditioned souls, have fallen in the ocean of nescience, but the human body fortunately provides us a good opportunity to cross the ocean because the human body is like a very good boat. When directed by a spiritual master acting as the captain, the boat can very easily cross the ocean. Furthermore, the boat is helped across by favorable winds, which are the instructions of Vedic knowledge. If one does not take advantage of these facilities to cross the ocean of nescience, he is certainly committing suicide.
Right, because then he'll just go back down into the animal species. He'll lose that position, the human position. So, by taking advantage of the instruction of the spiritual master, guidance of the spiritual master in the Vedic literatures, then that means then you have the boat has guidance and you have favorable winds. So one can cross the ocean of nescience very easily. Right? Otherwise, if there's no rudder, you just go around and around, and if there's no shastra, there's no wind. So imagine being stuck out in the middle of the ocean with no rudder and no wind. Mm-hmm. Not going anywhere very quickly. Right? And then, on top of that, the boat you're in is made of stone.
Yes. Yeah. One who boards a boat made of stone is doomed. To be elevated to the stage of perfection, humanity must first give up false leaders who present boats of stone. All of human society is in such a dangerous position that to be rescued, it must abide by the standard instructions of the Vedas. The cream of these instructions appears in the form of Bhagavad Gita. One should not take shelter of any other instructions. For Bhagavad Gita gives direct instructions on how to fulfill the aim of life. Lord Sri Krishna therefore says, Sarva dharmam parityajya mam ekam sharanam braja. Bhagavad Gita 18:66. Give up all other processes of religion and simply surrender to me. Even if one does not accept Lord Krishna as the Supreme Personality of Godhead, his instructions are so exalted and beneficial for humanity that if one follows his instructions, one will be saved. Right? If you don't, even you don't expect him as God, but you expect accept the teachings as good and follow them, you'll still get benefited. You won't develop love for Krishna, but you'll get benefited. Your social structure will work, things will work properly. Otherwise, one will be cheated by unauthorized meditation and gymnastic methods of yoga. Right? Because the hatha aspect is only one part of the whole Ashtanga yoga system. So they're giving you 1/7 and then, you know, presenting it as if it's complete.
So you can say yoga fully is cheating.
Yes, like that. So it's just, you know, they're just doing gymnastic methods of yoga. So they're using the gymnastics part, but that doesn't mean that it's, you know, you're getting the benefit. You know what I'm saying? You know, it'd be like, let's say, out of all the steps of brushing your teeth, all you're doing is taking the cap off the toothpaste and putting it back on, because the twisting motion is good for, you know, your fingers or something. You know what I'm saying? So it's part of the system, but that's what it's for. So the asanas, it's not about the asanas. It's about the meditation, but you do the asanas so that you have the physical health and all that, and you can sit and meditate. Right? That's the whole point. Yes?
Is it that they don't know that themselves, and
they're
trying to cheat people?
Some are cheating because people are able to be cheated. You know, some are trying to use the yoga system for, you know, meditation and that, but those kind of yogis, we're not going to see. You know, they're in the Himalayas, you're not going to see them. And then yoga studios in the West, someone's learned how to do asanas from, you know, some school, and then therefore then they teach the asanas and Hari Bol. It's just about physical health, and that's it. You know, it may give some peace of mind, you know, for a few minutes while you're there, so you're refreshed to go back out into Maya and battle away. But the whole point is it's not actually going to save the society. That's the point. Because their purpose, why do people go to the yoga studio? So their material life will go better. They're not going to the yoga studio to actually know about the Supreme.
I actually went to try to know about the Supreme, and I did yoga for a while, and I was wondering what power this is going to be spiritually.
Yeah, because most people don't know. Well, they don't know either. They don't know what to say. Because the guys who do know, they're not in yoga studios teaching yoga. Like that. Thus, one will board a boat of stone, which will sink and drown all its passengers. Unfortunately, although the American people are extremely eager to get out of materialistic chaos, they are sometimes found to patronize the makers of stone boats. That will not help them. They must take the proper boat offered by Krishna in the form of Krishna consciousness movement. Then they will be easily saved. In this regard, Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur comments, Asmamaya plavo yesham te yata majantam plavam anu majanti tateti raja nit upadesh shtri shu sva swabhyeshu kopo vyanjita. If society is guided by political diplomacy, with one nation maneuvering against another, it will certainly sink like a stone boat. Political maneuvering and diplomacy will not save human society. People must take to Krishna consciousness to understand the aim of life, to understand God, and to fulfill the human mission. Okay, so that's the point. The political maneuvering, all this, that's administration, management, all the, that's not what's going to save society. Yes?
Okay.
Yes, it's all part of that. It means people who are in in actual, how you say, real world, they use it as a tool. They don't use it as a lifestyle. You know what I'm saying? So it has this, it's a kind of tool that you speak proper words and that which the other person can appreciate and get your work done. You know what I'm saying? But it's not an ideal. You know what I'm saying? In other words, the conservatives use it as political tools. The liberals use a political tool and say it's somehow or another some ideal. So I'm not sure exactly how that works. You know, it's not working because society is becoming less and less cohesive. Does that make sense?
And political correctness is a tool which hasn't been used before in very time by kings.
Yeah, it's always used.
Probably not.
But it's part of politics. We take it as if it's some ideal philosophy or something, some actual social system. No, it's just niti, you're just getting something done. So naturally you speak in a way that the other person can appreciate what you're saying. That's all. So in other words, what things would work for those people you use. But the point is the basis has to be what is correct is established by Shastra. So we're interested in being shastrically correct. There was Shabda correct from Guru Sadhu and Shastra. Politically correct, that's not a philosophy, it's not a lifestyle, it's not an ideal. It's just a tool that you use to get anything done. Right? You know, something's not working in your neighborhood, and you want it done, you walk into, whoever is the authority in that area, and you speak nicely, and this and that, you get things done. You walk in there yelling, screaming, throw their chairs around, nothing happens. So that's it. It's also known as diplomacy. But if you say diplomacy, or being diplomatic, we're not into political, like that. But political correctness, it means it's correct politically. So it's politics. But we'll fall into the trap to think that it's something special and wonderful. Something one says, that's not politically correct, and we're all supposed to go, woo, and get afraid. Who defines correctness? It's not politically correct, but to who? Who's defining correctness? That's the question. That's the question that's not answered, that's not addressed, and no one wants to address. Right? Speaking nicely according to your particular persons you're with, in such a way that they appreciate and understand, that's just etiquette. That's just how you preach. That's how you talk. That's how you have conversations. But the point is in a society where that's not standard, finding fault and like that is standard, then being politically correct just means you're finding fault but doing it in a nicer way. So it appears that it's a step up. In other words, for those basically in anamoy and low levels of pranamoy, then it's a little bit higher pranamoy aspect, so therefore it seems superior. But if we try to control and adjust anandamoy with that, that's atheistic. That's just a total waste of time. Like that. But because it sounds nice, then people buy the stone boat. And then people go down in that stone boat. And then because they went down in the stone boat, someone else has to be wrong. So it's got to be authority, it's got to be Krishna, it's got to be gurus, it's got to be sannyasis, it's got to be the Shastra, it's got to be the Vedic culture, it's got to be something, because the political correct person can never be wrong. Because they're the ones setting the standard. If I say political correctness, I set the standard of what's politically correct. Right? Because if I don't like that particular form of political correctness, I'll just say, that's old, or only this people think like that. So it's completely arbitrary and whimsical. Say what you like, but that's reality. Does that make sense? So therefore, another stone boat. Right? Like that. Don't trust authority, just trust our minds, stone boat.
not interested in the Vedic system, but we take on all modern systems, stone boat. You know, success gurus will make devotional service nicely, stone boat. You know, management will make devotional service and society go nicely, stone boat. And you see the people who profess it, they go down along with their followers. Pure devotional service, that's real. Understanding what is pure, how to distinguish it from impure or mixed, right? That's real knowledge. That's real facts. That's real correctness. And anything else is illusion. Straight up front illusion. People say, oh no, but it's complicated, you can't say that because there's this consideration and that consideration. But according to the modes of nature, that's a mentality in the mode of passion. Goodness knows what's right and wrong. Ignorance thinks wrong is right, right is wrong. And mode of passion can't tell what's right or wrong. So those who are politically correct, they're in passion because they can't tell what's right or wrong. But because we're so used to it, because in the modern society, passion is considered, here's a guy that's doing something, and he's a leader, and he's exceptional and outstanding in the society of Mleches and Yavanas. Therefore, we take it as something elevated. The mode of passion, what has it gotten anybody? You say, oh, well, this one was successful here. Where are they now? Do we still hear their names? So that's the whole thing. We look for excuses. Yes.
Australia is really big on political service because I don't know in which way you're saying, but in Australia it's like it's used to stop people discriminating.
Yeah, but who sets the standard? What's discriminating and what's not? But who establishes the standards? But since when, and if the minority groups are in the majority, then what happens? You know, it's just like this. Let's say an American goes to Italy. He may not be dealt with so nicely. You know, an Italian in America, he's not dealt with nicely. You know what I'm saying? So that's the point, is whoever's the minority group, when they get in the majority, then they create trouble. Like in parts of America, whites are in the minority. When whites are in the majority, they make trouble. Then you put them in the minority, then now they're the ones that have problem. Why? Because the minority, who is minority but before is majority, now they make the trouble. So the point is where's the standard set? Who sets the standard?
No, it changes all the time.
That's the point. That's the mode of passion. That's what we're talking about.
But they don't need to get to be a majority to...
It's not about that. It's where does your standard of authority come from? You know, it's just like this. Go back 100 years, what's the position of Aboriginals? Right? And now they'll say, now the Aboriginals are, you know, important. You know, but if you go back a few... Yes, so, but my point is this. Catch, we're not just talking about... This is not a discussion about, you know, political correctness. This is a discussion about... The problem with political correctness is not accepting authority. Because without the Vedic authority, how do you know what is correct or not? There's laws of God. You're not supposed to discriminate against anybody, but you have to know what discrimination is. Right? Does that make sense? It's like, the point is that who drives your car? Can an 8-year-old kid drive it for you? Why not? You're discriminating. Why are you discriminating? He wants to drive the car. So you're discriminating. So this is nonsense. You understand? This is the problem with political correctness. There's no standard. It just happens to be wherever you apply a seemingly good point, but it's arbitrarily applied. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. So yeah. Huh.
Can you say that all this stuff is popular now because of the modern passion and ignorance?
Because of passion, anger is popular. Because if there is political correctness, people are trying to be nice, seemingly. So then I could get benefit from that. So that's what pranamoy is about. Pranamoy is how people can work together to get common benefit and sense gratification.
So it's all for profit.
It's all for profit.
Then it's more passion than
ignorance. It means its goal may be passion, but the knowledge in which it's based is which I'm the body and therefore I can enjoy my senses and all that. That's ignorance.
It's based on ignorance.
It's based on ignorance, and there's a touch of passion that it moves, it runs around a bit. But the basis is ignorance. That's why it's always falling apart. You know, so that's what Prabhupada's talking about. People want a society that works, you have to function in goodness. That's all. It's modes. That's all. You use the mode of goodness, society goes nicer. You use passionate ignorance, it always has problems. So for people who are worried about the mundane, this is how you make the mundane work. But the point is, since you're putting in that effort, so much effort, why only get that temporary mundane benefit when you can get an eternal benefit by connecting it to the Lord? Since the laws you're trying to follow come from the Lord. Does that make sense? Okay. If society is guided by political diplomacy, with one nation maneuvering against another, it will certainly sink like a stone boat. Political maneuvering and diplomacy will not save human society. Doesn't mean it's not useful, but that's not what it's going to save. Pranamoy is not the top. Anandamoy is the top. People must take to Krishna consciousness to understand the aim of life, to understand God, and to fulfill the human mission. That's it. King Indra said, therefore, with great frankness and without duplicity, I shall now bow my head at the lotus feet of Brihaspati, the spiritual master of the demigods. Because he is in the mode of goodness, he is fully aware of all knowledge and is the best of Brahmanas, of the Brahmanas. Now I shall touch his lotus feet and offer my obeisances unto him and try to satisfy him. So he's understood what's wrong and all that, so now he's going to try to correct the situation. Yes.
Second, we see quite often in the Vedic scriptures, they make the sankalpa, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that.
Right.
And also it's said that when we do that, so half of it is already achieved, so we might not achieve it again because we talk about
No. It's not that, because he's not talking about how he's going to do it. He's talking about that principle that he's going to be committed to doing this. In other words, by sankalpa, you know what you're doing. Many times people are doing something, they don't even know what they're doing or why they're doing it. So that's the whole point of sankalpa, is that your mind is focused. Because like in Yudhishthira Maharaj says, is that you have to have focus. Then there can be endeavor. And then you depend upon the Supreme. So sankalpa is for establishing focus. That's what it's for.
And which part you are not disclosing?
Means how he's going to find Brihaspati, or how he's going to put his head on his feet. Or, yes. Yeah. I mean, it depends on the situation. This is etiquette. He's done something wrong. He's correcting. He's mentioning like that. So it's also a benefit for the society, you know, to all those who are there. Does that make sense? So it's a proper thing.
Like at the end, we can see Indra is regretting all whatever he's done. Yeah? And when he's regretting, it means some portion of reaction will be gone, but he won't get such a heavy reaction. If someone done something, he regrets it straight away.
No, it's a matter of purifying yourself, because you're trying to... Yes, there is that aspect. And so then he has to take the proper endeavor. But yes, you could say, so one is purified by that. But that means regret means you understand what's wrong and what's right, and you can see that by acting in a wrong way, that's not proper, based on authority. Not that, oh, I acted improperly, now I get a bad result, now I should do something proper, and, you know, like this. So it's not a lamentation in the mode of ignorance. This is actually based on knowledge. This is mode of goodness. So one has to discriminate between what is lamentation and what is, you know, actual with knowledge, understanding what's right and wrong. Right? Does that make sense? There's a difference. One is you understand, so then you act on what's right. The other one, you just sit there and lament just about how something's gone wrong. It's not actually positive because you don't do anything. You know, you're trying to just by the emotions correct it, but it's no, you have to do something. You know what I'm saying? You left the dog outside, you know, then you, if you sit there and lament, or I left the dog, I'm so useless, I don't have any of this and that, and you still leave the dog outside, what does it do? The other person, oh, I left the dog, that's stupid, I should be more careful, you know, he's done this and that. So therefore, then you go let the dog in. Does that make sense? Like that. That's the problem, is that nowadays this regret means lamentation, not regret means based on knowledge. Because otherwise, oh yes, I'm so useful, I'm discriminating, I'm this, that, but based on whose authority? Right? You know, let's say, is it discrimination to be able to tell the difference between a person and a chair? Right? It requires discrimination to tell that. You talk to the person, you sit in the chair. So if everything's equal, then everything works just the same. So therefore, walking across the street or getting run over by a steamroller, it's all equal because you don't discriminate. You know what I'm saying? So it becomes rather foolish. One has to understand that this principle of seeing everyone equally is an important thing, but that means you're seeing on the platform of the soul. That everybody's transcendental. But the point is what's the interface with that particular soul? It's according to the particular body they're in, the particular mindset, the particular environment that you're in. Does that make sense? Yeah. So to indiscriminately dealing with people, that's not avoiding discrimination. That's just being indiscriminate. It's a different word. You know? Oh, we just, you know, include everybody, you know, and this and that. But the point is what gets done? Who organizes? We include everybody, but who's deciding to include everybody? We're putting ourselves in a position of authority. We say everybody should be included. But the Shastras say everybody should be included. You know, everyone has the right to know. But what does that mean? On what basis do they have the right to know? You know, do they have, is there such a thing, do people have a right to privacy? So who is the privacy about? Oh, they're an authority, so they have no privacy. So in other words, if you're an authority, then you're impersonal because you're not a person, you're not dealt with the person, but all the people that are managed by the authority, it all has to be totally personal and it's nothing to do with them, any obligations. I'm a person, I have full rights. You're a leader, you're impersonal, you have only obligations. You're not dealing with humans here. This is fifth class man. So it's all political. There's all these things that are mentioned here. They're political. You don't hear about it in the news. No one talks about it. It's that simple. You know what I'm saying? So that's the problem. Right? So we're supposed to hear from authority of some Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra, not authority by, you know, just modern... news media, or information media, I guess, more broad these days. Does that make sense? Yeah? Okay. Srila Prabhupada comments, coming to his senses, King Indra realized that he was not a very sincere disciple of his spiritual master, Brihaspati. Therefore, he decided that henceforth he would be nishtata, non-duplicious. Nishtaha
Oh, nishta. Nishata, shirshna, touch, charanam, sprishan. He decided to touch his head to the feet of his spiritual master. From this example, we should learn this principle enunciated by Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur. Yasya prasadad bhagavat prasado, yasya prasadan nagati kutopi. Oh, the A is back. By the mercy of the spiritual master, one is benedicted by the mercy of Krishna. Without the grace of the spiritual master, one cannot make any advancement. So that's the thing, is because Krishna doesn't want to have a direct relationship with us. He wants it to be through somebody, because then it makes it more nice. You understand? It doesn't mean direct interaction. What makes a grandchild special? Because of the direct relationship? No, it's indirect. It's the child's child. That's what makes it special. Right? But interaction can be direct. Grandparents, grandchildren interact directly. But the relationship's not direct. Therefore, it's sweeter. Right? You know what I'm saying? The grandparent is still having disagreements with their own children. You know, even though, you know, they're all in their 40s, 50s, 60s, like that. But no argument with the grandchildren.
It's more sweet.
Huh?
They're doing the same thing.
Doing the same thing, yeah, it doesn't matter. One is cute, and the other one, it's, you know, how many times have I told you? You know, yeah. So that's the point. It's because it gets sweeter as the farther back it goes. So therefore, dasana, dasana, dasana. So we approach Krishna through the spiritual master. But Krishna, you know, he knows how to deal. So those who are the direct ones, they're the most intimate. But we add to the sweetness. You know what I'm saying? Just like, let's say, I have a nice meal. Now, that's the important element. But now if I make the arrangements around the meal, I make it nicer. You know, and then some nice lighting, some nice music, nice company. It makes it better and better. It gets sweeter and sweeter, right? But it's still about the meal. So Krishna and his direct associates, direct servants, they're the meal. And then we are the servants of the servants. You know, who then assist in that. Does that make sense? Yes.
Can I say the same about Diksha and Shiksha Bhush?
Diksha
would be direct. And Shiksha, not necessarily direct, but the interaction can be.
Yeah, on one level, yes. Because, yes, you could say. You can't have it that there would be the other, but the general rule would be they're all in support of the Diksha Guru. Yes, yeah, so that, yes, you could say that. Yes. Yes, I mean, they're of course, but the point is when you actually surrender to the authority of spiritual master, then that means you're more serious. So anything connected to Krishna, Krishna's pleased. But the more serious, then it's more pleasing. Does that make sense? But as we see here, the instructions are the main thing. So following the order of Siksha Guru, that gets a long way. Like that, because Siksha is always going to be there. Is that? A disciple should never be a hypocrite or be unfaithful to his spiritual master. In Srimad Bhagavatam 11:17-27, the spiritual master is also called Acharya. Acharyam mam vijaniyan. The Supreme Personality of Godhead says that one should respect the spiritual master, accepting him as the Lord himself. Nava man yeta karahichit. One should not disrespect the Acharya at any time. Namartya bhudyas suyeta. One should never think the Acharya an ordinary person. Familiarity sometimes breeds contempt, but one should be very careful in one's dealings with the Acharya. Aghadha dishanam dvijam. The Acharya is a perfect Brahmana and has unlimited intelligence in guiding the activities of his disciple. Therefore, Krishna advises in Bhagavad Gita 4:34, Tadvidi pranipatena pariprashnena sevaya. Upadekshyanti te jnanam jnaninas tattvadarshinaha. Just try to learn the truth by approaching a spiritual master. Inquire from him submissively and render service unto him. The self-realized soul can impart knowledge unto you because he has seen the truth. One should fully surrender unto the spiritual master, and with service, sevaya, one should approach him for further spiritual enlightenment. Right, so that's the principle, is that one has to, we're trying to learn the truth. The truth means devotional service. So then the spiritual master will show us what's the difference between what's spiritual and what's material. Right? What pleases Krishna, what doesn't. That's the whole point here. So therefore the Acharya, in this case Srila Prabhupada, he establishes all these. Then all the other senior Vaishnavas, then they give what's called relevant instruction. They try to make, they assist Srila Prabhupada in making his instructions understandable and accessible by their dependents. Does this make sense? Because that's what you're trying to do. Does that make sense? So that means then that's parampara. Right? Just like when we discuss devotional service, then who's the authority in devotional service? Oh, sorry? Yes, but I'm saying, who is everybody quoting? Prabhupada, but who is he quoting? But that's a devotional service in general, but the process of bhakti, who's the Acharya? Rupa Goswami. You understand? So we're representing Prabhupada, Prabhupada's representing Rupa Goswami. Rupa Goswami is representing Lord Chaitanya. So that's how the parampara works. Right? Someone can say, oh no, but they're not on this platform. But the point is just try. So approaching, has one approached? Is one inquiring submissively? Is one rendering service? If one's not, then what's our position to make a comment? A real disciple can make a comment if someone's a real guru or not. But someone who's not acting as a real disciple, they should are in no way, no position to make comments about who's a guru or not. Does that make sense? Yeah. So, oh, well, when they're advanced, then I'll surrender. It's like that. No, even when they're advanced, you won't surrender. And how do you know they're not advanced now? Because you don't know how to surrender. So the principle is, I don't surrender anyone. I trust myself. I trust my own mind. Therefore, such persons, it doesn't matter. They won't surrender. Like that. That's the position. Sukadeva Goswami continued, while Indra, the king of the demigods, thought in this way and repented in his own assembly, Brihaspati, the most powerful spiritual master, understood his mind. Thus he became invisible to Indra and left home. Right? Because he knew he was going to come. But, you know, it's not just in one sense. It's proper, the mentality. But it's serious because he gets distracted. So if it works out so easily, he might not understand. So then there should be a little bit more endeavor. Because it was a big mistake, then there should be a, you know, suitable endeavor to correct it. Right? For Brihaspati was spiritually more powerful than King Indra, right? Because he's from a higher platform. Although Indra searched vigorously with the assistance of the other demigods, he could not find Brihaspati. Then Indra thought, alas, my spiritual master has become dissatisfied with me. Right? Because before he thought, etiquette-wise is wrong. I'm the king, I'm the leader, I should do everything right. So this is there. Only when he was searching, couldn't find him, then he thought, oh, my spiritual master is upset. Because otherwise it wasn't so much about the spiritual master, it was about following proper etiquette, which is good. But it's still a lower level than understanding pleasing the spiritual master is actually the higher principle.
So it says. And now I have no means of achieving good fortune. Although Indra was surrounded by demigods, he could not find peace of mind. 16 to 17. Verses 18 to 25, the demons defeat the demigods. In verses 18 to 25, the demigods become weak due to offending their guru, and the demons who were properly worshipping their guru, Shukracharya, defeated the demigods in battle, forcing them out of their palaces, right? So the point is respecting the guru gets you all value, right? I think there's a Chinese saying, one who respects the teacher respects himself. Right? In other words, it's just a common thing is that even on the material platform, you respect, you know, your authority, then things will work properly. Right? No matter what it is. Then it will go nicely. So the demons are respecting their spiritual master, even though they're only learning from material things, and they become materially very powerful. Well, the demigods, because they disrespect it, then they lose their potency. Right? So we can never be disrespectful, you know, claiming we're just being practical or, you know, oh, we're not into all that etiquette or we're not fanatic. You know, you can say all these things you want, but it doesn't matter. The modes of nature will do work according to God's law, not our whim. Is that? Therefore, we have to follow the etiquette. Yes?
Like here, Brihaspati wanted Indra to learn
yes.
lesson very generally, then we are also like doing. Within devotional service, does this apply? Like, when we want somebody to learn a lesson, then we allow them to.
It depends. Are we an authority in such a position? Can we correct all that? So the point is you can't let something happen that you yourself can't correct. Is that what it is? Thank you. In a pitiful state, Indra and the Devatas approached Lord Brahma, who chastised them for not following Vedic culture and advised them to accept Vishwarupa as their guru, even though he was family to both the Devatas and the Daityas. You know, he's a qualified Brahmin, but, you know, the position is that he's connected to both families. Sukadev Goswami continued, hearing of the pitiable condition of King Indra, the demons, following the instruction of their guru, Shukracharya, equipped themselves with weapons and declared war against the demigods. The demigods' heads, thighs, and arms, and other parts of their bodies were injured by the sharp arrows of the demons. The demigods, headed by Indra, saw no other course than to immediately approach Lord Brahma with bowed heads for shelter and proper instruction. When the most powerful Lord Brahma saw the demigods coming towards him, their bodies gravely injured by the arrows of the demons, he pacified them with his great causeless mercy and spoke as follows. 18:20. Lord Brahma said, O best of the demigods, unfortunately, because of the madness resulting from your material opulence, you failed to receive Brihaspati properly when he came to your assembly. Right? Because Indra is at fault because he's the leader, but everybody else, they also could have just stood up. If they had just stood up and stopped their prayers and all that, then naturally Indra would have stopped and taken notice. But nobody stopped. Indra being the lead, then he's naturally the most responsible. But the point is they were all at fault. That's why it's not just Indra lost his prowess. They all lost their prowess. Right? Because all the demigods are disciples of Brihaspati. Right? You know, headed by Indra. Yes.
Both demons and demigods are his children.
Yes.
So it seems that he's sometimes quite biased
to the demigods. Because they're assisting the Lord in the universal order, while the demons are only, you know, following enough laws to not make too much trouble, to just enjoy the material world. So they're not actually taking part. You know what I'm saying? Let's say the father has 10 sons at home. And five of the sons, they assist in, you know, the father's responsibilities. And the other five behave nicely, do everything, but just enjoy the facilities of the house. You know what I'm saying? So naturally, you're going to give more attention and facility in that to the ones who are assisting. The affection is there for both, but it's going you naturally because that the responsibility is there. You have to make things work. So, but, you know, he saw that Vishwarup being a Brahmin, even though he has parents on both sides, then, you know, he'll be the suitable person. Right? Okay. Because of madness resulting from your material opulence, you failed to receive Brihaspati properly when he came to your assembly. Because he is aware of the Supreme Brahman and fully in control of his senses, he is the best of the Brahmanas. Therefore, it is very astonishing that you have acted impudently towards him. Because he's so exalted, why would you act like this? Because you have material opulence. But higher that is that understanding the knowledge and having, you know, understanding Brahman. That's way beyond. Because they're managing the universe so that people become God-conscious. So here is someone who is more God-conscious than them. How could that be disrespected? And thinking just the opulence is actually the main point. Srila Prabhupada comments. Lord Brahma recognized the Brahminical qualifications of Brihaspati, who was the spiritual master of the demigods, because of his awareness of the Supreme Brahman. Brihaspati was very much in control of his senses and mind, and therefore he was a most qualified Brahmana. Lord Brahma chastised the demigods for not properly respecting this Brahmana, who was their guru. Lord Brahma wanted to impress upon the demigods that one's guru should not be disrespected under any circumstances. Right? There's always some, it has to be dealt with properly. Because it means, how you say, it's a personal process. We get worried about, leadership deals impersonally. And then we reciprocate in kind. So how is that in any way, shape, or form better? Oh, that's how they dealt with us. So then you're just as in a bad position as them. Narad Muni, you know, if we go by that, Narad Muni should have cursed Daksha. But he didn't. That's why he's in a superior position. That's it? Fixed in the holy names you came for when we're going to sing, say Hare Krishna. Okay, very good. Very good, very good. Okay. When Brihaspati entered the assembly of the demigods, they and their king, Indra, took him for granted. Means they and their king, all of them. Since he came every day, they thought they did not need to show him special respect. Well, that's the specialist, he's coming every day. As it is said, familiarity breeds contempt. Being very much displeased, Brihaspati immediately left Indra's palace. Thus all the demigods headed by Indra became offenders at the lotus feet of Brihaspati, and Lord Brahma, being aware of this, condemned their neglect. So that's the thing, is spiritual life, spiritual is never a problem. So Mother Jashoda never at any moment, deals without in any neglect of Krishna. Neither the gopis nor the cowherd boys, nobody in the spiritual world does. So that's the thing, it's always, every moment's unique and special. But in the material world, is if something's around and then we think we're in control of, you know, and enjoy, then we don't take it seriously. So that's the material disease. That's why the first principle in spiritual life is you have to overcome this by respecting the spiritual master. And we may like that, may not like that, but it really doesn't matter. We should understand with knowledge why it's important. Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Jai Shri Prabhupada. Hare Krishna. Samavita Bhakti. Jai Nitya Gaur Pindar.